The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening. Welcome. So tonight I thought of sharing some Dharma poetry with you. This is poetry from the actual Buddhist teaching. And the particular poetry that I want to share is by a lot of scholars of the Buddhist texts considered to be some of the oldest teachings in the whole set of teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha taught for about 40, 45 years, something like that. And my sense of this particular set of poems is that it kind of gives a different flavor of the Buddha in some ways. In a lot of the texts, he's surrounded by, you know, it says 500 monks are sitting around. And in this one, you get a different picture of the Buddha. It's like he's just wandering around the landscape and sitting and talking to people he runs into. And so it feels like, just the flavor of it feels like it was before he was so well known or something. I don't know. But in any case, one of the reasons they say that this is an older text is that it's one of the very few pieces of text that is referred to in other places in the text. And the conversation when it's referred to goes something like this. Have you memorized that set of poems? No, I haven't. Or yes, I have, and I'll recite them for you, or something like that. And so it was maybe understood to be a set of teaching poems. And this set of poems is found in the small collection. It's a kind of a lesser collection or less well-known collection of texts called the Sutta Nipata. And the poems themselves are called the Atthakavagga, which translates roughly as the Chapter of the Eights. And there's not particularly a good reason why they're called the Eights, because there are 16 of the poems, and they all have more than 8 verses, so there's no particular understanding of why they're called the Chapter of the Eights, but that is what they're called. This set of poems, and I'm not going to be able to go through all of them, I'm just going to kind of give you a flavor of these, and also just kind of a flavor of the themes of what this particular set of poems offers. It's the main theme, actually, of these poems, it's kind of like they are an ode to clinging and letting go of clinging. Those of you who are more familiar with the Buddhist teaching know that the theme of clinging is a theme that goes throughout his teachings, where it's understood that the clinging here means a kind of an orientation of our minds to want things to be a certain way, to want things to go our way, to continue to experience things we want to experience, to not experience things we don't want to experience. This whole flavor of things is understood in the Buddhist teaching to be one of the main reasons why we actually struggle in our lives. It maybe sounds counterintuitive, but a way I phrased it the other day is accepting things as they are, you know, being able to be with experience as it is maybe the path of least resistance through our lives. And the trying to kind of continually resist and shape and pull and push creates a sense of stress and struggle in our lives. And it's not, the teachings actually don't say that we shouldn't act and try to engage in the world to make change. I mean, the whole of the Buddha's life was about trying to help people understand how to live a happier life. And he acted in doing that. He taught, he supported people in understanding what might help them to actually live a happier life. And so it's not to say that we should just kind of sit back and not do anything. But there's a way in which we engage often in our lives where we are really fighting things that are happening, as opposed to kind of like, it's almost like what we learn to do in our practices in an Aikido move. In Aikido, it's like if somebody is coming at you with a certain energy, it's like you kind of align with that energy and then you redirect it so that it doesn't create harm. And this is kind of the energy of non-clinging. We align with things as they are in this moment and then use a kind of a wholesome direction of our hearts, a kind of an orientation towards non-harming and letting go of constriction in our lives, to kind of have that energy move in a different direction. And so this is the kind of an overview in some ways of the teaching of non-clinging. And so these poems talk about clinging and what it means to not cling. And two key avenues are explored here, clinging to sense pleasure, which is a big way that we orient in our lives, wanting to have sense pleasure, wanting to have pleasant sense experience, to not have unpleasant sense experience in our lives. That's one major avenue of clinging. And the other major avenue of clinging that is pointed to in these poems is clinging to views, ideas, beliefs, opinions. And, you know, it doesn't take much reflection right now in our culture to recognize how much suffering is happening because of clinging to views. And so the Buddha, in his time 2,600 years ago, highlighted this as something that we ought to pay attention to. And so we'll see how far we get in this exploration, but I just wanted to kind of give you an overview of the terrain of the poems, and then also give you a little bit of a sense of how these poems work. So there's 16 of these poems, and pretty much they fall into one of three camps, one of three perspectives that are being spoken to. And I'll offer, you know, a few from each of these three camps. There's a set of poems that basically describe the ordinary human condition, the condition of somebody who has not undertaken a training or a curiosity about a different way to live in this world, and is kind of caught in the habitual ways that humans are caught. It's not so much of a judgment. It's not framed, to me at least, it doesn't feel framed as a judgment, but more as just an expression of the kind of poignancy of how human beings typically engage in the world and what happens, what that results in. And so that's one set of the poems describing the perspective of the world from someone who has not really met the teachings. And then there's a set of poems that describe what it's like to be free, what it's like to not be clinging, what it's like to have kind of aligned, to have our system aligned with the path of least resistance, and how does that person move in the world? So that's the second set of poems. And the third set of poems is, how does one get from one to the other? Kind of what's the path by which one would move from being caught in the ordinary life and the possibility of being free. So the first set of poems, An Ordinary Person. Here's a few selections from that. And this first one is about clinging to sense pleasure, what happens. If one, longing for sensual pleasure, achieves it, yes, they're enraptured at heart. The mortal gets what they want. But if for that person, longing, desiring, the pleasures diminish, they're shattered as if shot with an arrow. One who is greedy is overpowered with weakness and trampled by trouble, for pain invades them as water a cracked boat. And so this is essentially pointing to the, well like both the understanding that the normal way of engaging in the world, getting what we want, longing for sense pleasure, longing to get rid of things we don't want, is kind of yes, there's a happiness in that. There is a way in which it brings a little bit of happiness. It says, yes, they're enraptured at heart. They get what they want. And yet, it also points to the kind of what happens because all experience, whatever's going on in our lives is impermanent. And so the pleasures will diminish. This is a guarantee. Have you found a pleasure in your life that lasted forever? And if we actually look at that and reflect on it, no, they don't. We don't really expect them to last forever. And yet we do think that somehow that's the best happiness that's available. And so we, like having a pleasure, that one fades. We feel, you know, it depends on how it fades. Sometimes it's just like we get bored with it. Or actually sometimes it might happen that we lose it or it breaks or, you know, something happens to it. We have a relationship and the relationship breaks up and there's a huge pain in our heart. So the diminishing or the lessening of those pleasures, getting those things that we want, sometimes it happens in different ways how we lose them. But if we lose it, and so the suffering of losing it in a shattering way, we feel, we understand the pain of that, and we recognize the pain of that. But if it fades, often we don't so much recognize the pain of that, but what we end up doing is we kind of maybe get bored, or we feel like, well, things aren't as exciting as they could be, and so what can I get so I'll have that excitement again? And so we're off looking for something again, and so we're kind of on this, you know, hamster wheel maybe of getting what we want, having it fade, maybe then looking for the next thing, having it fade, sometimes getting what we want, sometimes not. And we basically think that's as good as it gets. And yet, the Buddha actually discovered for himself that there's a deeper kind of happiness, a deeper kind of ease and peace that's possible. And I think many of us just have no idea. You know, it's like our culture isn't set up to point out to us the happiness of a calm mind. Our culture isn't set up to point out to us that a different kind of happiness comes as we kind of relax and stop trying to fight and push-pull around the world. What's here, what's not here. There's a description, an analogy that's given about how somebody is in this place of, you know, looking for something, having it for a little while, and then kind of getting on this kind of hamster wheel. It says, longing for what's over or what's to come, yearning for pleasures in the present and pleasures of the past, those who are desirous of pleasure, hunting for it, have entered the wrong road. Look at them, floundering amidst their cherished possessions like fish in a dwindling stream. And at one point I had in my meditation kind of this sense of what it's like to be a fish in a dwindling stream, you know, the losing your nourishment and feeling like, you know, where can nourishment actually be found? And the flopping that happens with the fish in that situation, it's like never able to be calm or at ease because continually having to look for the next little bit of nourishment, flop, 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 trying to find that next little bit of water. And then there's some verses that talk about the clinging to views. So those were clinging to sense pleasure. And here's some descriptions of clinging to views. And as you think about this, as I read these, you know, this was written 2,600 years ago, about 2,600 years ago, but just open your mind to what's happening in our culture, in particular in the political realm in these times. Does this sound familiar? Abiding by fixed position, abiding by fixed opinions, and pleased with themselves, they say, "My opponent's a fool, they're no expert." Upon whatever basis they regard their opponent a fool is the same upon which they regard themselves as an expert. To the extent to which they rate themselves expert, they despise anyone else who makes the same claim. And this is one of my favorite verses in the entire text. Those attached to perception and views roam the world offending people. And then there's a kind of a question that somebody asks the Buddha. Those who maintain a view and dispute, saying, "This alone is true," is criticism all they experience? Don't they also receive praise? And the Buddha responds, "What they receive is trifling, not enough to bring them any peace of mind. I say there are only two consequences of dispute, praise and criticism. Seeing this, you should not dispute. Regard instead non-dispute, the grounds for peace." Now, this doesn't mean that we don't understand what our perspective is. It doesn't mean that we say views are useless, but it is an understanding of perhaps a different way to hold views. Views perhaps as useful for navigating life. Views as perspectives that have been that have shaped both our lives and shape how we see our lives. What the Buddha points to here is the consequences of holding to views. That we want to prop up our own views and disparage the views of others. And so he points to the dispute, the quarreling as being something that is not so helpful. But he doesn't say, I don't see that he says in here, I mean, there are places where he says, and I may get to this in a bit later, places where he says things like, "No view is worth clinging to," but I don't understand it to mean that no view is worth, you know, holding, perhaps, or using as a perspective, and understanding it as a perspective. Because all of the Buddha's teachings, too, are views. And so there's a way in which we can see that, you know, and the Buddha actually taught at one point, he said, you know, even these teachings that I'm offering are not meant to be clung to. That will create struggle and suffering if you cling to even what I teach as a view. It can be used. He talked about using the teachings as a raft, something to help us, to support us, to cross over the struggles and stress, the river, the flood of confusion. And so he talked about using views to help us and yet not clinging to them. And so we'll see if we get to views a little bit more in a bit. So that's a little bit about how an ordinary person, some poems about an ordinary person before they meet the teachings, how they might relate to sense pleasure and views. And then a liberated person. I'm going to just say a few words about, before I read this, how this particular teaching talks about somebody who's liberated. And liberation in the Buddha's understanding is basically, I mean, one way to frame it is liberated from clinging, liberated from wanting things to be other than they are, liberated from that kind of push-pull about the world. And yet, you know, it's an interesting place because, I mean, what basically I understand this liberation to be is, you know, what has come to be in this moment? There is something that is here right now, some experience, some feeling, maybe some contraction, maybe something painful, maybe something pleasant. Whatever is here in this moment, it has come to be already. It has come to be based on a whole history of causes and conditions. History of causes and conditions of our own personal lives, of our culture, of the planet, of the universe, actually. It's like so many conditions have come together to have us be sitting here in this room together. And all those conditions have come together, and this experience is happening right now. The experience that's happening right now is already happening. It's here. It's already happening. And yet what we do is we resist. We don't like, often we either want to hold on to it because it's pleasant, or we want to get rid of it because it's unpleasant. And the non-clinging is, my understanding is, like, it's not clinging to wanting what is already here to be different, because it's already here. Resistance is futile. It's here. And paradoxically, what I've seen in my own life as I kind of align with, oh, this is what has come to be, and my heart and mind can expand to include both the challenging and the delightful, then the next step into the next moment has a kind of a skill to it. It's got an orientation that isn't about kind of aversion and greed, but more about wisdom and compassion. And so action arises, action, we step into our lives. When we align with what's here, it's kind of like aligning with the truth. That's what we're doing with this non-clinging. We are aligning with the truth. This is what's here. And as we align with the truth, our hearts begin to step into the next moment, not with aversion, reactivity, greed, but more with compassion, wisdom, love, kindness, generosity, patience. And so action happens not from reactivity, but from more responsiveness. And so this freedom, this liberation that's spoken about is freedom from clinging, and also is sometimes described as freedom from mental pain and grief. Freedom from greed, freedom from aversion, freedom from delusion or confusion. And so while there may be unpleasant experience happening and a responsiveness to pleasant and unpleasant experience, our minds remain at ease. Our minds remain peaceful. And this is a hard perspective to understand from the perspective of being motivated habitually, as we all are and have been, motivated by wanting things to go our way, wanting things to move in the direction of having pleasant, getting rid of unpleasant. It's hard to understand why we would do anything if we didn't want to have something or want to get rid of it. And so this takes a little bit of a leap of faith to step into this path and begin to recognize that when I do align with things as they are, it doesn't mean that action stops. opens us and orients us to action from a different perspective. A perspective that, basically the perspective of aversion cannot comprehend this perspective. The perspective of greed can't comprehend this perspective of aligning with the truth and being responsive. And so it's a little bit of a leap of faith for us to step into this possibility. And so describing the description of somebody who's free here, you know, it talks about somebody who is free from clinging. And it's kind of striking to me the way this person is described. And so I'll read this to you and then try to pull out some things that I find kind of noteworthy about this. A questioner said to the Buddha, "I want to ask you about the perfect person. There are those people we call one who is calmed. Can you tell me how they see things and how they behave?" And the Buddha responds, "One who is calmed, who has extinguished all cravings before the time the body disintegrates into nothing, who has no concern with how things began or with how they will end, and no fixation with what happens in between, such a one has no preferences. They have no anger, no fear, and no pride. Nothing disturbs their composure, and nothing gives them cause for regret. They are wise who are restrained in speech. They have no longing for the future and no grief for the past. There are no views or opinions that lead them. They can see detachment from the entangled world of sense impressions. They do not conceal anything, and there is nothing they hold on to. Without acquisitiveness or envy, they remain unobtrusive. They have no disdain or insult for anyone. They are not full of themselves or addicted to pleasure. They are gentle and alert and show no aversion to anything without any blind faith. The sage, free of greed and selfishness, does not speak of oneself as among those who are superior, equal, or inferior. The sage regards nothing in the world as one's own and does not grieve because of what does not exist. Not blindly following religious teachings, such a one is called truly peaceful." So the thing that stands out, I mean, there's a couple things that stand out to me in this is basically this isn't a description. I mean, we might think, you know, enlightenment. What might that be? I mean, we might, in our minds, before I began meditating, I had heard this word enlightenment. I prefer the word freedom or liberation myself at this point. But enlightenment is kind of a word in our culture. And, you know, I kind of had this idea of what it might be. You know, what might that be? It might be, I don't know, some state of mind of like bliss. Or, you know, just continual happiness or something, you know, some idea of what somebody would have when you were enlightened. That was kind of my idea, is that you would get something when you were enlightened. And what this describes is primarily what they are not. Not angry, not fearful, not pride, no preferences, no blind faith. Not clinging to religious teachings, not blindly following religious teachings, no aversion, not comparing. And so, to me, this points to, well, a couple of things. It points to really how deeply this path is about letting go. And also that this leaves a lot of room. Because for me, there's like... it's like when we're not talking about what we get in freedom, but what is let go of, it's there's a lot of room for being who we are. You know, there's a lot of room for different expressions of somebody who's free. I've met some people in Burma, when I traveled in Burma, I met some people that seemed very free to me, very at ease with themselves, very peaceful, and they were so different. You know, that wasn't like becoming enlightened makes everybody the same. It's greed, aversion, delusion are let go of. One person I met was so calm. I walked into his monastery and I just felt like I was walking into a sea of tranquility. Another I met, he was so happy. He was continually laughing. It was just delightful to be with him. At one point, we went to visit him. He was old. I think he was in his late 90s. He's died. He died a couple years ago. And maybe his early 90s. And I went to see him, and he had been sick. He was sitting in this chair, and he looked kind of shriveled up. He couldn't move. They had to carry him around, carry him up and down the stairs. And I had to speak to him through a translator because he doesn't speak English. But my recollection is that I heard him say this in English, and maybe it was just because of the laughter. You know, he said, "Oh yes, I've been very sick. I almost died the other day." I was like, "Really? Wow!" You know, to have that lightness. And so there's a lot of room for kind of individual expression, I think, in freedom, which makes me happy. You know, it makes me happy to think it's not like something that just makes everybody the same. The other thing that I think is kind of notable here is, again, it's very ordinary what's described. It's described as somebody being not afraid, not angry, not fixated. Restrained in speech, no, not concealing anything and not holding on to anything. And so these are kind of its descriptions that we can relate to. They're descriptions of how we might understand. I mean, maybe we've seen somebody who wasn't angry in a situation we thought they might be angry in. And so we can connect to this description of somebody. It's a description we might be able to recognize. I mean, we probably haven't met anybody who's like this all the time. And yet, to me, it's this poem about what freedom is emphasizing what it might be like to be free and walking around the world and engaging with people and talking to people and being a normal person in the world. It's not a description of somebody who is sitting on a mountaintop somewhere in continual state of bliss. It's a picture of somebody who can be engaged. And to me, that's inspiring, that this description in the teachings points to a person who's free being somebody that, I mean, I can envision this potentially. I mean, I certainly haven't experienced like complete freedom from anger. But I have experienced times when anger falls away or when anger doesn't arise, and it used to arise in situations like that. And I can have a taste of what it might be like to be free. A sense, an understanding of that possibility. And so to me, this teaching emphasizes the possibility for freedom in this very life, and describes it in a way that is, to me, relatable. Now, to me, this contrasts quite strongly with some of the kind of traditional teachings in some of the Buddhist traditions, which really emphasize, you know, the whole the notion of freedom. What it means is that you are free from any more rebirth. Well, it's kind of a kind of a metaphysical description of what happens to somebody when they're free. You know, that you're off the chain, you're off out of the cycle of multiple rebirths. And for me, I don't have any sense of, for myself personally, in my experience, any sense of rebirth. And so that particular teaching isn't so evocative for me personally. I know people for whom it is, and yet for me, what is more inspiring is the possibility of freedom in this life and seeing what has been possible for myself as I have engaged in these practices, how much more ease and peace and happiness I experience in this life. And the description here just so much resonates with me, that possibility for freedom, what that might be. In one scholarly study about this particular text, it's noted that this is a particularly non-metaphysical teaching. You know, metaphysical being kind of transcending the physical, transcending the world. The teaching is really like here and now. What's it like here and now to be free? And a couple of quotes from a couple of the scholars who studied this text. One said, "This text is exceptional, even within the earliest Buddhist literature, in its non-metaphysical presentation of the highest good achievable by humans. It is significant as an example of how the Buddhist ideal can be presented without all the usual problematic, cosmological, and metaphysical accessories that accompany it in its traditional doctrine." And another quote, "This text sets out to find or describe a practical solution to human sorrow, not the abstract sorrow of rebirth, but the everyday sorrow of strife and aggression." And to me, that is what is inspiring about what I have found valuable in the Buddhist teaching, in this text in particular. And then in the last bit I'll share, and then we can open it up for discussion, some poems that describe how do we get from the one who is caught, the cracked boat, on that hamster wheel, flopping around like a fish in the water, the dwindling stream, to this person who is at peace. That's another word that I like particularly for freedom, is peace. And as I said, the Buddha described the state of freedom as being no mental pain or grief. Now that doesn't mean that, compassion is a heart state that feels the pain of others, but is kind of resonating in sympathy with it. And so it doesn't have a quality of constriction to it. So, states like that, the emotional kind of terrain of this mind at peace, my understanding is that the way that mind meets the world is that when there's a being, when there is relationship in the world, it basically meets that relation with love. And when there is suffering to be found, that love is kind of has the flavor of compassion. When there is delight and joy in that relation, the response is one of sympathetic joy, kind of resonating in tune with that joy. And basically, the mind is one of balance. So this is kind of what we might call the emotional map of a heart that has peace. It's not a flat. It's not flat. It's this heart fully meets both the suffering and the joy of the world, and responds to it with action, but not reaction. And so how do we get from one to the other? Here's a description of that. And again, it's a person who comes to the Buddha, and it's again presented as just a single person. The Buddha's just talking, sitting down and having a conversation with a single person. And this person has been asking questions. And this question that the Buddha responds to is, please tell me about the path of practice. What is the path that you teach? What is the path of practice that you teach? And here's what the Buddha responds. A person should not have covetous eyes, should close one's ears to ordinary chatter, should not be greedy for flavors, should not cherish anything in the world. One should be meditative, not footloose. One should desist from worry, should not be indolent, should live in lodgings where there is little noise. One should not sleep too much. One should be devoted to wakefulness and keen endeavor. One should abandon laziness, deception. One should not fear blame, nor be conceited when praised. One should drive out greediness, selfishness, anger, and malicious speech. One should not be a boaster, nor speak scheming words, should not cultivate impudence, nor utter quarrelsome speech. One should not be drawn into telling a lie, nor be deliberately treacherous. One should not despise others for their way of life, or wisdom, or precepts, or practices. If ascetics or ordinary people irritate one with their talkativeness, one should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. Knowing the Buddha's teaching, an ever-attentive person who investigates it should train in it. Knowing the cooling of desire as peace, one should not be negligent in applying the teaching. With regard to the Buddha's teaching, one who is diligent should constantly venerate it by following his example. And so a couple of things here. I mean, it's kind of, to me, this is basically, it's almost like it took the description of someone who is free and says, well, one should try to be like that. You know, so modeling, it's like a modeling what it looks like to be free. In my own experience, this kind of modeling, there's an art to it. And so I'll offer this to you because I think it's crucial. I think it's spoken to here. And when it says, if people irritate one with their talkativeness. And so it doesn't say, okay, stop being irritated. It says, don't respond harshly. For the peaceful do not retaliate. And so it is, you know, it's recognizing, to me, this recognize, yes, we will be experiencing all of our ordinary emotions. We will experience worry. We'll experience, where's the first part of that? We'll experience greed, we'll experience cherishing, we'll experience those things. And so the should here, one should not be greedy or for flavors, one should not cherish anything in the world. My understanding of what that means is that there's this middle way that the Buddha teaches. Because if we try to say, oh, I'm being greedy. I should stop being greedy. That leads to repression. That leads to kind of further clinging, a self-judgment, an idea that I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing. And I don't believe that is what the Buddha's teaching. What he is teaching instead is something much more subtle, which is recognizing, wow, yes, greed is happening right now. And what a skillful response is to that in the moment is to recognize that's what's happening right now. I talked a few minutes ago about aligning with the truth of what's happening now. Like greed has arisen. Of course greed has arisen. Aversion has arisen. Of course aversion has arisen. We've practiced it so much in our lives. It's been a kind of our orientation for so long. But what a new orientation here is a new relationship to that experience. Instead of kind of doing what we normally do with greed, which is like, oh yeah, that thing, I want that thing. Let me follow that kind of path of trying to get it. Or, oh, that aversion, I got to get rid of that thing. Instead of doing that, the exploration is something like, oh, what's happening right now is greed is arising in this moment. This is what it feels like to be a human being experiencing greed or aversion or worry or irritation. This is that experience. And that's that Aikido move where we recognize it's align ourselves with, oh yes, this has arisen. But what we are not doing is kind of, it's kind of like what we do there. Because our habitual way of being with things like that is that we have something we don't like. We want to get rid of it. It's like we've got our foot on the gas pedal to get rid of it. And the gears are engaged. Our thoughts, everything is going to kind of keep that aversion going. So we are engaged with that. Yes, I need to get rid of that thing. I'm only going to be happy when I get rid of that thing. That person shouldn't be doing that thing. It's like we are spinning those gears, the gears are engaged. And what this practice does, oh, this is what it's like to feel aversion in this moment. It's like disengaging the gears, taking our foot off the gas pedal. Now, when we do that, when we disengage the gears, we think about the analogy of a car, for instance. We take our foot off the gas pedal and put the car into neutral when we're going 60 miles an hour. The car doesn't stop immediately. It's got some momentum. And yet, perhaps we can, you know, steer the car until it comes to a stop. And kind of similarly, we can perhaps be mindful and aware of that experience of aversion or greed or worry or irritation or impatience or confusion or anger or rage or fear, whatever it is. Maybe we can be aware of that, not put our foot on the gas pedal of thoughts like, oh, this is why I need to do something about it. And we perhaps can then witness it kind of coming to a stop as the car comes to a stop when the gears are disengaged. This is my sense of what it means to do this kind of practice. And in terms of the, the appearance, the modeling, it's like we might engage by acting as though we were peaceful, acting as though we were not angry or confused or frustrated, and yet fully knowing inside, yeah, this is the experience of anger arising in this moment. I've done this practice, this kind of practice. It's a delicate, it's like walking a fine line to not repress the feeling while engaging in a kind of a counterpoint behavior. And yet it's extremely powerful. I've watched, when I've done this kind of thing, I've watched a mind state just kind of wither as I fully understood, yep, impatience is arising right now, and yet I'm going to act as though I had all the patience in the world. So kind of both fully understanding, ooh, that urge of impatience, and acting as though I were patient. Very powerful. It's somehow that action kind of has a rebound effect on the mind. It lands on the mind. And it's partly because what we're doing there is we are cultivating the intention of patience, even as we might feel impatient. And I think this kind of practice is what is pointed to here, this modeling of the teachings. And the Buddha, it's said, even in this last sentence I read, with regard to the Buddha's teaching, one who is diligent should venerate it by following his example. If you want to be peaceful, act peacefully. So again, I find this kind of a simple and yet very profound and challenging teaching. You know, it is not, absolutely not about repression. And yet, definitely it's transformative. A very powerful, powerful practice. And so there's a couple of minutes if there's any reflections or comments. Yeah, and could you use the mic?
One thing I've been working on recently in my practice, it's something I call vegan alligator.
The
vegan alligator. The vegan alligator. Because many times I'll go into things where someone is a certain way, and he's going to be a certain way. And even though he may even be working against his own best interest, he'll do something that for one reason or another it is. And what I have been telling myself and the people working with these, sometimes alligators eat fish, you know, or birds or whatever. They eat meat, right? And you can't get mad at an alligator for eating a fish.
It's nature.
Right.
That's its nature.
So that is an alligator that's eating fish, and it's very difficult to create the vegan alligator.
Yeah.
There's the thought that you can, but it's a very hard. So you're swimming upstream. So it's, you know,
yeah.
And so I've replaced that. When something would go like that, I would be with people and I'd say, in not very flattering terms, right? But I've come to vegan alligator, and it's seemed to help me a lot. I don't know how closely aligns with the Dharma, But it came through my practice, so I just think that...
Well, it sounds to me like it's kind of an acknowledgement in some way of meeting, as you meet somebody who's behaving in a certain way. It's like we recognize through our practice how conditioned our own life is and how hard it is to change our own minds. And we see that. As we see that, we begin to recognize, oh, yeah, everybody else out there, too. They have their conditions. And to me, that's kind of what you're describing, the alligator. It's his nature is to be that way. And to try to make the alligator be something he's not is an exercise in struggle. And yet, sometimes people do change. We can change. And yet, because we have that capacity to change, We have more capacity to change
There's
than an alligator
the hope
does.
The alligator will be vegan, but there's always that hope. So
there's the hope of change, and yet not counting on it essentially. So I think that is what you're pointing to,
yeah.
And a recognition of kind of just understanding and recognizing, yeah, wow, everybody else too has their whole history of conditioning behind them too, and how hard it is to kind of turn the battleship. It can be turned. It is possible in this case to make a vegan alligator, using that analogy. It's possible. It's possible. And yet that person has to want to change. too. It's right. It's got to come from them. So and yeah, so it's I think it's very aligned. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that image. Mm-hmm. And it's time to stop. So thank you all for your attention. Thank you.